coaches, and doctors had cautioned her not to run until it healed. That was like asking a cheetah to sit still, and it had depressed and frustrated her no end. But she'd endured and built her strength, and now the x-rays showed the sesamoid had solidly fused. That was 10 weeks ago. Since then, her coaches had been taking her workouts up slowly, trying to get her in shape before. Alex? I turned to my right and saw a fit man in his 50s with graying hair coming at me in silver warm-up pants, a blue hoodie, and white Asics running shoes. A small pair of binoculars and a stopwatch dangled around his neck. Nice of you to come, Coach, I said, shaking Ted McDonald's hand. Couldn't miss Wonder Girl's return, McDonald said. How's she looking? A little stiff and a little scared, frankly, I said. The coach's face fell. That's not good. I know, I said. But let's see how it plays out. Only thing we can do. In the end, it's up to her. McDonald was a private coach from Texas who'd started working with Jenny the year before the injury. At the time, he'd been talking about her track and field potential in Olympic-level terms. I wondered if that would be the case an hour from now or ever again. This is a good test for her, McDonald said, as if he could read my mind. Good surface, short track, and tight curves. No matter how Jenny runs, her sesamoid will be stressed. How's that a good thing? McDonald had always been straight with me, so I expected candor, and I got it. We'll know quick if we're beyond this setback, the coach said. And if we are, we can turn our attention to something other than the bottom of her foot. No wonder Jenny was feeling uncertain, I thought. No wonder she was afraid. This was like a verdict coming down. I tried not to let my mind wander to my own upcoming trial, and I kept up an easy conversation with McDonald before the 400-meter competitors were called to the line. Jenny stepped up in lane 3 of the stagger, as ready as she'd ever be for 2 laps around the indoor track. She'd gained 10 pounds of muscle since she'd last raced, but she was still built like a gazelle, with long, springy legs and arms, and still fairly thin compared to the other older competitors moving to their starting blocks. McDonald pointed at the young lady in lane 5. That's Claire Mason, Maryland High School indoor record holder in this event. She just signed a national letter of intent to run at Stanford. Our girl know that? Nope, McDonald said. She's just down there to work her plan. The starter called the runners to their marks. My stomach was doing flip-flops. In her last race, Jenny fell coming out of the blocks, which may have contributed to the fracture. Sit, the starter said, his pistol raised in the air. Jenny coiled. At the crack, she broke clean and I heaved a sigh of relief at the way she came out attacking, her legs churning, her torso fighting to get upright, and her arms pumping toward the first curve and the first real test of the injured bone. She blazed through the tight turn with relative ease in no evident pain and accelerated down the back stretch. The staggering of the runners began to evaporate as they came through the second turn, Jenny in fourth. Be disciplined now, McDonald said, glancing at his stopwatch. Jenny raced down the front stretch, picked off the girl in third, then passed the one in second. That left only Claire Mason in the lead with 1 lap to go. Damn it, Jenny, McDonald said. That's not what we... My daughter thundered after the Maryland High School champion, but Mason held her off through the third turn. From my daughter's past performances, I figured that the second time down the back stretch would be Jenny's surge, that she'd find some reserve no one had predicted and blow past the girl in the lead. Instead, Mason pulled away from Jenny. The girl in third overtook Jenny in the fourth turn. Jenny was gritting her teeth, giving it everything she had. But 40 meters from the finish, the girl in fourth passed her. The girl in fifth got by her 2 feet before the wire. Jenny slowed to a stop, glanced around in bewilderment, then looked up at Coach McDonald and me. She threw up her hands in despair and exploded into tears. Chapter 12. I jogged along the reflecting pool between the Washington and Lincoln memorials. The dawn was cool, almost crisp, and it felt good to be moving and breathing fresh air. During my morning runs, I usually tried not to think about anything besides putting one foot in front of the other. But that day, I couldn't get my mind off Jenny. Coach McDonald had told her before the race that she wasn't there to attack the leaders and win. He wanted her to get a clean start, stay close to the leaders, and kick at the end. A training session and a test of her foot. Instead, Jenny got full of herself and went after what she wanted instead of staying with McDonald's program. It had caused a rift between them. The coach told me he was rethinking how much time he had to dedicate to her. Nonetheless, her foot had held up. No pain, no discomfort. I checked my watch and picked up the pace until I was nearly sprinting up the marble stairs toward the imposing statue of the 16th and greatest president our country has ever known. I'd been inside the rotunda where the figure of Lincoln presided and read his quotes dozens of times, but they always gave me a chill. I didn't have a chance to glance at them today because a petite, intense, Indian-American woman in a blue business suit and a trench coat stepped out from behind one of the columns. She carried a briefcase and a large Starbucks coffee cup, and she tilted her head, indicating we should leave. "I should not even be here," FBI Special Agent Hannah Batra said in a low voice. "I should be talking to Samson or your wife." "But you're here," I said as we climbed down the memorial steps. "Did you look at the website link I sent you?" Batra did not reply, just cocked her head in a way that said I was a fool to have even asked. Men and women far smarter than me will tell you that we are on the verge of the singularity, a moment in time beyond which all human brains will be able to access all possible information through the power of the Internet. As far as I was concerned, Batra was already at one with the Internet. Plugged in, she could reach across vast digital landscapes, unlock almost any door, and peek into some of the web's dimmest hiding places. She was also one of the smartest people I'd ever known. Before Batra had even graduated from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, she had 8 high-paying job offers with the search engine and social networking crowd. Instead of accepting any of them, she joined the FBI and its growing cybercrimes unit. I'd met her during the course of the investigation that led to the murder charges pending against me. That alone explained Batra's reluctance to meet me in a public place. She was proud of being FBI, and she was a woman of great personal integrity who cared deeply about her reputation. But she'd come, which meant she thought it was worth the risk, which meant she had looked at killingblondchicksforfun.org.co. "Come on, Batra," I said. "Any luck unlocking those videos?" "Can a pickpocket pick?" Batra said, heading toward the Vietnam Memorial. "What did you find?" "Nothing," she said. "The videos all end a second or two past the locking point. I suspect if a user has the correct passcode, the 2 extra seconds are revealed and a secret onion router message is sent to the webmaster. At that point, the webmaster would send back an onion router message with a complete encrypted film attached."
"Hold up," I said. Most of that went right over my head.
"Start with onion." The cybercrime specialist took a sip of her coffee and said an onion was a digital message or order that left a computer surrounded by layers and layers of encryption and code, almost like an onion. "When you send out an email or look at a website," she said, "you're leaving digital tracks all over the so-called clear web. But when an onion message or order is sent, the surrounding codes direct it through dozens of routers on the deep or unorganized web. Each router peels away layers of encryption and metadata that would identify the original sender. Onions guarantee anonymity," Batra said. "We can't look at them. The NSA can't even look at them." "Why?" "Because we won't even know they exist. Done right, they leave virtually zero trace." "You're kidding," I said, disappointed. "I'm not kidding," Batra said, her face clouding as we entered the Vietnam Memorial. "This is serious black net stuff you've gotten yourself into, Cross. Almost everything having to do with that website was done through onions, so I have no idea who built it or who maintains it."
Can't you hack it? What's to hack? Batra said. The website is anonymously built and self-sustaining. I can shut down whatever the hosting URL is, but I'd imagine there are dozens of mirroring sites with the content on them already. I thought about that. You said almost everything having to do with the website was done through Onion routers. Batra arched an eyebrow and said, "You're smarter than you look, Cross." One of my redeeming qualities. What was not done through an Onion? Those posts on the hacker's bulletin board. Those I could track, and I did. All of the posters, I said, impressed. Just the high-volume ones so far, Batra said. What do we know about them? Creeps, the FBI agent said, taking another sip of coffee. I was getting chilled, so I untied the hoodie around my waist and put it on as she continued. On the clear net, they troll porn, Batra said. In the dark net areas where I can track them, they're into lots of sicker stuff. I wrote it all down. Where are they? You mean physical location? All over the world. Though, one of the regular creeps posting is definitely local. How local? I said, stopping. Right here, she said, waving her coffee cup. D.C. You have a name? Address? Batra studied me several beats, calculating what to tell me, no doubt, and then said, "Close enough." Chapter 13. Leaving the Brookland CUA metro stop later in the day, I knew damn well I shouldn't have been walking up John McCormick Drive. I could hear Bree in my head saying I had no authority here and that my time would be better spent working on my defense for trial. But I was back in the game. And who was going to tell Bree or anyone? The creep? Not a chance. The creep would want to avoid any contact with legitimate law enforcement. And I just might learn something useful about Gretchen Lindell and the other missing blondes, which would more than justify my actions as a concerned citizen. With that firmly in mind, I went to the security guard at the main entrance to the Catholic University of America and asked how to find the alumni office. The guard gave me a map. I thanked him and started in that direction until I was around a corner and out of sight. Then I made my way to Flather Hall, a brick-faced dormitory for male freshmen. Classes were over that Friday. Rap and heavy metal music pulsed and dueled from inside open dorm rooms. I spotted a few underage drinkers and smelled hemp burning as I made my way to the second floor and down a long hallway that reeked of too many young men living on their own for the first time. The door I sought, number 278, was ajar. I stood there, listening, hearing nothing, and then knocked. No response. I pushed open the door, saw bunk beds to my right and a single twin bed across the room. Two white males in their late teens sat on a love seat between the single bed and me, wearing Beats headphones and holding video game controllers. They were absorbed in a violent game playing on a screen on the wall, oblivious to my presence. Beyond them, at a desk tucked in the corner, there was a third white male, small, scrawny, oily brown hair, lots of acne. Three computer screens dominated the small desk where he sat, and he had headphones on as well, engrossed in the screens. I reached over and flicked the dorm room light off and on twice. As if a hypnotist had snapped his fingers, all three of them came up out of their virtual trances and looked around groggily. The closest kid, a chubby towhead named Fred Wirtz, spotted me first. His double chin retreated, and he tugged off his headphones. "Who are you?" he said. "What are you doing in here?" I waited until the other two removed their headphones before making a show of shutting the door behind me and locking it. They were alarmed when my cold attention swept over them. "Who are you?" Wirtz demanded again. "Who I am is irrelevant," I said. "Hell it is," said Juan Sire, the other young man who'd been playing the video game. Sire was built like a fullback and stood up to show me he was no one to be trifled with. Brian Stetson, the kid with the acne and the three computer screens, said,
"Don't do anything else stupido, Juan. I'm calling campus security."
"Do that, And I'll have to tell campus security what I know about what goes on in this dorm room, I said. They glanced at one another uncertainly. Wirtz, who could have used a shower or two, said,
We don't know what you're talking about, man.
Okay, let's cut right to it then. Before I alert the NSA, the FBI, and six other law enforcement agencies. Gentlemen, which one of you is Lone Star Blonde's must die? Chapter 14. Wirtz's eyelids drifted almost shut. Stetson frowned, as if he'd heard a foreign phrase spoken at a distance. Sire acted like I'd punched him in the gut. Then, the burly teen's expression shifted from shock to anger. He twisted his shoulders and hissed at Stetson.
I told you messing around with that kind of crap was mind poison. Shut up, Juan, Stetson said, studying me calmly. Who are you?
The worst kind of poison, unless you come clean, I said, feeling like I'd identified the leader of this crew. How old are you, Brian?
18, he said. How do you know my name?
I know all your names. I know you get your kicks exploring the dark web, pushing the boundaries, looking into nasty places.
Free world, Stetson said.
Dogfights, I said. Explicit war clips. Hardcore S&M fantasy sites.
There's some law against watching I don't know about, Stetson said.
No. But there are several against abetting the kidnap and advocating the murder of five women. That seemed to rock the kid, who looked less certain as he said,
I know what that means, abetting, and no one in this room abetted anything.
Didn't you post a comment on a bulletin board about the Killing Blonde Chicks website? Quote, I want into that site. I can contribute, help, break some skulls even. He looked at me dumbly, then at his computer.
You hacked me?
FBI hacked you, Stetson. You screwed up. Forgot to use onion routers. Which means that I should go to the dean's office and tell him what you've been up to. Which means you most certainly will be expelled. Which means your parents will be called. Which means you'll be escorted out of here in complete disgrace and humiliation. I let that sink in before saying, Or you can talk to me. After several tense beats, Wirtz said,
I'll talk.
Fred, Stetson said,
don't. Brian, my old man will skin me alive if I get expelled, Wirtz said sharply. I'll talk too, Sire said.
Stetson's face flushed. He glared at me, caught in a fierce internal argument, and then finally said sullenly,
What do you want to know?
Over the next 20 minutes or so, the story came out. Stetson was a math and computer genius who should have gone to Caltech, but his father was a trustee and fervent supporter of Catholic University. His first night at the school, Stetson had introduced Sire and Wirtz to the dark web. They'd found the Killing Blonde Chicks website and started posting about it for fun.
Fun? I said. Come on, Stetson said. No one thinks those videos are real.
Have you unlocked the videos?
You can't. I tried. The locked world, the unknown. It's just part of the fantasy of virtual reality, man. A place to safely experience and vent frustrations without consequences.
I reappraised the 18-year-old, thinking that he was entirely too smart for his own good. You boys experience frustration with blondes?
Hasn't every guy on the face of the earth, Wirtz said.
Sire and Stetson both started laughing. I had to admit it was a funny line, and I fought not to smile. Finally, I said, If I look around in your past, am I going to find a blonde one of you disliked so much that she ended up kidnapped or dead? Sire said, My first girlfriend was a blonde. Caught her messing around with my best friend's older brother. They're married now, not kidnapped, not dead, just miserable. Wirtz said,
My anti-blondness stems from a severe German teacher junior year who had zero sense of humor. I thought about sticking a pin in her ass, but refrained. At least long enough to get an A.
Stetson and Sire laughed again. I couldn't help it and smiled. What about you, Brian? I said, looking at Stetson. Stetson sobered and said, "My blonde story is like all blonde stories. They're all about the princess complex that's sold to them each and every day."
Chapter 15. After dinner, once Jani had gone upstairs to do homework and Ali had settled in to watch Meru, an excellent documentary about extreme mountain climbers, I told Bree and Nanamama about Brian Stetson, disguising him as a client and not revealing his name.
"The princess complex," Bree said. "And how exactly did he define that?"
"He said it starts at birth with blonde girls," I said. "They're dressed as princesses in the crib, then they're sold the princess story in movies, in advertising, all around them, until they believe that if they can just be beautiful enough, they'll attract Prince Charming and live happily ever after."
Nanamama said,
"An 18-year-old told you all that?"
"A sharp one. He had the root theory of blonde stories figured out."
Bree said, "I knew a blonde who was just like that, treated like a princess her whole childhood. Leanne Long. She was an honest-to-God nice person, and she became a nurse and married a really nice guy, so it doesn't always work according to that kid's theory."
"This old lady needs her sleep," my grandmother said, taking her cane and getting up.
"We're right behind you," I promised. "We'll make sure the place is spotless for you in the morning."
"Bless you, dear," she said,
and she kissed my forehead. When Nanamama was out of earshot, Bree turned serious and said,
"Alex, how long did you think you could be involved in the Gretchen Lindell investigation without me knowing?"
"The client story didn't work?"
No.
I told her the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. When I was done, Bree was spitting mad.
"What were you thinking, going onto campus like that?" she demanded. "Entering a dorm room without a warrant, threatening possible witnesses without authority, and while on suspension due to pending homicide charges."
I'd known most of that was coming, but it still hurt. I'd let her down.
"I wanted to be useful, Bree," I said. "It felt like I was back in the game."
"Your clients and practice are your game now. Have nothing to do? Work on your defense. Help Anita and Naomi make your case ironclad. And the next time you feel the need to lie or hide things from me, Alex, please don't."
I had a hollow feeling in my stomach and said, "You're right. You're right. It will never happen again." I hoped she'd forgive me. I hated going to sleep when one of us was mad at the other. After several moments, Bree sighed and said,
"So you don't think those college boys are involved?"
My shoulders relaxed. I felt like we were getting back to level ground. "Beyond the posts, no, not as far as I could tell."
"You don't think we should get a warrant for their computers?
And get them all expelled for being smart, nosy teenage male nerds with blonde chips on their shoulders?"
"Well, when you put it like that," Bree said, getting up and extending her hand to me.
I took it, kissed the back of her hand and said, "Princess?" She started laughing, said,
"Charming?"
I got up, grinning. "That's me."
Chapter 16.
John Sampson had never heard a collective grief quite like this. The crying, wailing, and whimpering seemed to come from every room he passed.
"Innocence destroyed," Sampson thought. "Up until now, their lives have been one shooting star after another, and that's gone."
Looking shell-shocked, Wally Christian, Georgetown University's security chief, walked beside Sampson and Detective Ainsley Fox down a hall on the first floor of Village C West, a residential building for freshmen. A DC MP patrol officer stood aside so they could go through the double doors into the common area. Sampson paused just beyond the doors and took in the carnage with one long, sweeping glance. A young brunette in a Hoya sweatshirt was sprawled on a couch, dead, a gunshot to her neck. A second young woman with short brown hair lay face down and dead on the carpet. EMTs rushed out of the room with a gurney carrying a very large Samoan-American male with two chest wounds.
"How many saw it?" Sampson asked.
"Seven," Wally Christian said. We've moved them to the common room upstairs. The chaplains are with them.
Who's the missing girl? Fox asked.
The blonde?
Patsy Mansfield, Christian said.
A sophomore, real star.
As in, people knew who she was, Samson said.
On campus, you bet.
She plays lacrosse, All-American as a freshman, and well, you've seen the picture of her I put out with the Amber Alert. She's quite the looker.
As all of them took the stairs to the second floor of the dorm, Samson thought of what Alex had told him over the phone about the three freshmen at Catholic University with bad attitudes about blondes. He wondered if they were involved here and made a note to check on their whereabouts at the time of the incident. The seven witnesses to the homicides of the brunettes and the kidnapping of Patsy Mansfield all told much the same story. 11 students were hanging out in the lounge around 7 that Saturday evening when two men came in from outside. They wore black balaclavas and olive green workman's coveralls with Georgetown University written on the back. They drew pistols with silencers and ordered everyone to the floor except Patsy Mansfield.
Wait, Detective Fox said. They used her name?
Definitely, said Tina Hall, a freshman.
They knew who she was.
Hall and the others said the two men told Mansfield that things would go easier if she just went with them. But then, Keone Latupa, a linebacker on the football team, and a good friend of Patsy's, grabbed one of the men and threw him to the ground so hard that his gun clattered away. Latupa scrambled for it, but the other man shot and wounded him before he could get to it. The loose gun came to a stop at the feet of Macy Jones, the brunette in the Hoya sweatshirt. She went for it and was shot too. At that point, Denise O'Toole, Jones's roommate, went to help her friend. She was shot in the leg.
Then, the first guy got up and retrieved his pistol, said Tina Hall. He went over to Keone and shot him again. Then he went to Denise, who pleaded with him not to shoot her, just to take her, but not shoot her.
Hall paused, tears welling in her eyes, and then dripping down her cheeks. She went on.
Know what he said before he killed Denise? He said, "Why would we take you? Nobody pays for brunettes anymore."
Chapter 17. The D.C. Police Union had referred my latest client to me. She knocked on my basement door shortly after 9 Monday morning. I opened the door and found a dark-haired woman in her mid-30s standing there, her shoulders slumped. I knew her, but she was so haggard, I almost didn't recognize her.
Tess, I said, holding out my hand.
It's good to see you. Detective Tess Aaliyah lifted her head, tears streaming down her cheeks.
I'm embarrassed and uncomfortable to be here, Dr. Cross. But my union rep said you were the only counselor available on short notice.
Come inside, and please don't be embarrassed or uncomfortable. I'm not a detective now, and not here to judge you in any way. You need to talk. I'm available to listen. And of course, nothing said ever leaves the room. The detective hesitated and then came inside. I followed her into my office, remembering the confident, smart, and attractive woman who'd helped save my family after they were taken by a madman named Marcus Sunday. Aaliyah was from a police family. Her father, Bernie, had been a top detective in Baltimore, and she'd lived and breathed the job when we'd worked together. I knew some of the trauma she'd been through lately, and as I shut the office door, I prayed that I was up to the task of counseling her. I got coffee for her and gestured to a chair. She sat down, her head tilted low and her upper torso and shoulders rolled forward as if in surrender.
How are you feeling? I asked.
You've seen the news. How should I feel?
Forget the news, I said. Lift your chin, straighten your shoulders, and give me your side of it.
Conflicting emotions flickered on the detective's face as she made a slight alteration in her slouch before telling me the story. She and her partner, Chris Cox, had gone to a high-rent apartment complex off Judiciary Square to serve a warrant on and arrest one Drago Kovac. Kovac had immigrated to the U.S. from Serbia when he was 9, become an American citizen at 15, and become a car thief shortly thereafter.
He wasn't very good at his chosen field at first. Kovach was caught and convicted of Grand Theft Auto twice before his 18th birthday. After that, he wised up and got sophisticated. He formed an auto theft ring that worked the Miami to Boston corridor, boosting in-demand cars, chopping them up for parts, and then selling the parts over the internet. Kovach was now 27 and operating his illegal enterprise from his luxury flat on 3rd Street in D.C. Aaliyah, looking for spare parts for her Ford Explorer, had happened on one of his websites which offered gently used parts for a third of what other sites and stores were asking. When she learned the company and Kovach were based in D.C., one thing led to another, and then to a year of additional investigative work. "We had him," Aaliyah said. "I mean, this was a major criminal operation, millions of dollars, and we had him dead to rights." "So you go to Kovach's apartment building to serve the warrant," I said, pushing her toward the awful truth. "Yes," Aaliyah sighed. "We went in at the exact same time arrests in this case were supposed to go down all over the East Coast. Synchronized, you know?" But, unbeknownst to Aaliyah and her partner, several warrants had been served early. When police in New Jersey went through the front door of a Kovach chop shop, one of his men got off a text warning of the raid. Seconds before we reached the 10th floor of his apartment building, Kovach and his men left his flat, Aaliyah said. Cox saw them at the far end of the hallway and ordered them to the ground. They ran, and when we pursued, they shot.
They definitely shot first?
No question, Aaliyah said, a smolder of the old fire in her eyes. Surveillance cameras back us up.
Okay. Kovach and his men shoot first, then what?
That glowing ember died in Aaliyah's eyes. Her neck muscles went taut as piano wires before she said, "Then it all became a nightmare." Provoked into a gun battle, Aaliyah and her partner followed protocol and returned fire. Her first shot hit the meat of Kovach's thigh. Her second and third shots missed the car thief, who, howling in pain, lunged into the stairwell. "I was in pursuit when the wailing started behind the door at the end of the hall," Aaliyah said, and she broke down sobbing. "I knew the rest. She and Cox caught and arrested Kovach and two accomplices, but at an unfathomable cost. The bullets that went wide of the car thief had gone through the door of the apartment belonging to the Phelps family. Oliver, a young successful attorney, Patricia, a young successful physician, and their twins, 4-year-old Megan and Alice. Alice had been playing in the front hallway. The nanny had rushed to get her at the first shot.
"What are the odds, Dr. Cross?" Aaliyah asked, still weeping bitterly. "What are the odds of wounding the nanny and killing the girl?"
Chapter 18. After Aaliyah poured out her anguish, her grief, her guilt and despair, she pulled her feet up under her on the chair, wrapped her arms around her knees, and stared off into the distance. "In the end, I'll always be the cop who killed a child," she said hollowly. "No matter who I was before or who I become after, that's who I will be."
"To who? You?"
"I pulled the trigger, Alex. That's what they'll write after I die."
"I empathize with the pain and regret you must be feeling. But you don't know what the future holds for you. None of us do."
She blinked slowly, said, "There is a way to know your future for certain." That got my attention and concern.
"Have you thought about that, Tess?"
Aaliyah took a big breath and then shook her head.
"No, not really."
"Not really?"
"Not at all. I'm just trying to find a way to process this, you know?"
There was little conviction in the detective's voice, and she appeared preoccupied.
"Are you sleeping?" I asked.
"Some days it's all I do."
"Self-medicating? Alcohol? Drugs?"
"Honestly, I wish they'd work, but they don't, so I don't."
"When does the civil suit go to trial?" Aaliyah continued to avoid eye contact.
"I don't know what they expect to get from me. This has already cost me everything."
I continued to watch her, thinking about the flat affect in her voice and expression, the defeated way the detective was holding herself, and some of the statements she'd made, especially talking about herself in the past tense.
Tess, I think I'd feel more comfortable if, for your own safety, we take you somewhere to get a proper, in-depth evaluation of your current condition.
Aaliyah raised her head for the first time in many minutes, gazed dully at me and said, I'm nowhere near the padded room.
Given what you've been through, suicidal ideations are cause for serious concern, Tess.
This could be a medical issue that...
No one's putting me in a psych ward, Aaliyah said, getting to her feet angrily. Least of all, me.
Tess, sorry, she said, heading for the door.
I thought I could trust you, and I was wrong. Goodbye, Dr. Cross.
After a long look at the situation, I came to a decision, grabbed my jacket, went outside, and hailed a cab. Chapter 19. We pulled up in front of the D.C. Police Union building 20 minutes later. I paid the cabbie, went inside, and asked to see William Roth.
Did I have a meeting set up with Mr. Roth?
The receptionist asked.
No. Had I tried to call him?
I thought it was a dire enough situation to come down to talk with Mr. Roth in person. It wasn't until I told him it might be a matter of life and death that he called upstairs.
Mr. Roth was in an important meeting, the receptionist told me after hanging up the phone.
You didn't explain the gravity of the situation? Call back. The receptionist rolled his eyes, snatched up the phone again, and dialed.
He says break into the meeting. It's that important, he told someone.
The receptionist waited, and then hung up and said,
Go on up. Third floor, second door on the right. Roth's not happy.
I don't care, I said, and I took the stairs up. I knocked on the door and then entered an anteroom with a very irritated secretary at her desk.
Mr. Roth has been working for this meeting for 6 months, she said.
Would it matter if someone you cared about was in danger?
Well, she said, flustered, I suppose so.
Where's Roth?
Roth's right here, said a flushed, bald man who appeared in the open doorway behind the secretary.
This better be good. I've got people at a table I never expected to...
It's Tessalia, I said, walking past the secretary into Roth's office.
You're her rep, correct?
Aaliyah, Roth said with mild disdain.
Dear God, what's she done now?
You sent her to me this morning for an evaluation. I believe she's depressed and possibly suicidal.
No, Roth said, taking a seat at his desk. I saw her last week. She was bummed, but knew it wasn't her fault that the little girl was playing in the front hall before the shooting started.
I don't think Aaliyah cares about anything, which can be chemical, and which is why I need your help getting her into a psych ward for 3 days so she can be evaluated by medical professionals.
You want me to commit Aaliyah? Roth said incredulously.
No, absolutely not. Even if I had that authority, and I don't, absolutely not.
Aren't you supposed to look after her, represent her?
In the shooting, yes. But this? No.
The depression and suicidal thoughts followed from the shooting, I said firmly.
She needs help, more than I can give her.
You tell her that?
I did.
What did she say?
That she was upset but fine and nowhere near the padded room.
There you go then, Roth said, getting up. I have a meeting to run.
I blocked the door and said, You don't care about Aaliyah's well-being?
I care, Roth said. But if you want her in a psych ward, convince her doctor or someone in her family to recommend it, or get the department to make it a stipulation of her suspension revocation. Any way you try to do it, though?
Yes.
Expect her to fight. Chapter 20. After several unsuccessful attempts to reach her, I spoke with Esther Dodd, an attorney for the police department. It was obvious by her curtness that Ms. Dodd was none too happy to take my call, probably due to the murder charges pending against me. She listened impatiently and dismissed out of hand my request to have Aaliyah undergo psychiatric evaluation as soon as possible as a stipulation of her rejoining the force.
She's on suspension with a lawsuit pending, the attorney said. That puts Detective Aaliyah in limbo and gives us very few options, especially since your evaluation was done on behalf of the police union. With all due respect, it holds no weight from a legal perspective. Goodbye, Dr. Cross.
I tried to find Aaliyah's doctor next and lucked out when a friend in the Human Resources Department checked some old records and gave me a name, Dr. Timothy Cantrell. I looked Cantrell up and found he was not only an internist but affiliated with GW Medical Center and its famous Tropical Medicine Division. I called Cantrell's office but found that the physician, a member of Doctors Without Borders, was currently out of the country working in Brazil to stem a yellow fever outbreak. I was frustrated, but refused to give up without making every effort. At 2:12 p.m., after making the long drive, I turned down Francis Street in the small town of Arbutus, a suburb of Baltimore, and soon found a small blue-and-white bungalow with a neatly tended yard. A raw northeast wind had picked up and caused me to shiver as I ran up the walk and knocked at the door. A tall and very put-together red-headed woman in her late 50s answered the door. I introduced myself, and her features softened.
"I've seen you on the news," she said. "Tess and Bernie say you're innocent, wrongfully charged."
Her name was Christine Prince. She was Aaliyah's father's girlfriend and was happy to tell me that Bernie had gone off surf fishing, his passion in retirement. I asked when he'd return, and she said that he'd gone to one of his favorite spots out on Assateague Island, so he probably wouldn't be back until around midnight. After a few moments' hesitation, I asked if she knew where on Assateague he went to fish.
"You're going all the way out there?"
she said after showing me on a map. I need his advice, and I think he'd want to give it to me sooner rather than later.
"Tess," she said softly.
"You're a mind reader, Christine," I said. "Thank you for the help." 2 hours later, I pulled into Assateague Island State Park. The ranger station was closed, and I found Bernie Aaliyah's Jeep Wagoneer parked right where his girlfriend said it would be. When I got out, the wind clipped me, and the sky spat rain. I dug in the trunk of my car and came up with an old rain jacket and a pair of calf-high rubber boots I kept around for crime scene work. I put them on, and with my hood up to block the wind, I walked up the trail, through the dunes, and onto the beach. The Atlantic was gray and roiling, but to my left, there were surfers out on the swells, clad head to toe in black neoprene, and to my right, there were six or seven anglers. I stood there, looking at the anglers one at a time, until I saw an older man limp fast toward the crashing surf and then use his powerful shoulders to whip out a heavy fishing rod with a big pink lure. I thought the lure's arc would die quickly in the wind, but it had just the right angle, and it punched through, landing in the water far offshore. As I started toward him, he pumped the rod tip up and down several times, paused, then did it again. When I passed his chair, his cooler, his tackle box, and two Coleman lanterns yet to be lit, he twitched it a third time. "Bernie Aaliyah," I said. The old man startled and looked over his shoulder at me, huddled in my rain jacket and hood.
"I know you," he said.
I pushed back the hood. "Alex Cross, sir." Tess's father's face broke into a toothy smile.
"So you are. Been a long time, Dr. Cross. I've been following your career from way back."
"I followed yours when I was at Johns Hopkins, sir," I said.
"Hold on. Let's do this proper,"
Bernie said, sticking the butt end of his fishing rod into a piece of white PVC pipe buried in the sand.
"There now."
He turned awkwardly, due to a gunshot wound to his pelvis that had ended his remarkable career in Baltimore homicide, but he shook my hand with a vigor of a man half his age.
"To what do I owe the honor of you driving all the way to hell and gone to see me?"
Bernie asked. "It's about Tess," I said. "It's serious." Chapter 21. After I described my concerns and the evidence to support them, Bernie Aaliyah was quiet for several moments, standing there, looking off toward the waves crashing and the falling light. "I saw my daughter 3 days ago,"
he said at last. Tess was still grief-stricken, still remorseful. But I didn't see suicidal, Dr. Cross. And I certainly will not go to court over her wishes.
I don't discount your observations, Mr. Aaliyah, I said. And maybe you don't want to legally compel Tess to undergo a full psych evaluation. But you could convince her to commit herself. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I'd rather stand here with my tail between my legs than stand next to you at a grave. Before Aaliyah's father could reply to that, there was a sharp popping noise. We both turned to see his surf-casting rod bending hard, the line straight and quivering.
"That's a good one!"
he cried, scrambling over to the fishing rod and grabbing it before it could come free of the PVC pipe. Bernie held the rod tight about 2 feet from the bottom, the butt still in the pipe. He leaned back, testing the weight of the fish and its strength.
"Oh, Jesus!" Bernie said. "He's gonna go 40 minimum, maybe 50!"
The reel started to whine. Aaliyah's father reached down and adjusted the drag to let the unseen fish run. He let it tear out 100 yards and saw the line slacken before he snatched up the pole from the PVC pipe and reset the drag.
"Bernie," I began. He barked.
"I've been waiting on this quality of fish for 2 years running, Cross, so you can either leave or wait until I'm done here."
I held up my hands.
"Don't let me get in your way."
So I stood back and watched the retired homicide detective engage in an epic battle on the beach. Every time Bernie was able to pull and crank the fish closer to shore, it would make another run that left him gasping.
"Oh, he could go 60,
Aaliyah's father said with a grunt 20 minutes into the struggle.
"Big, big striper."
35 minutes into the fight, he said,
"Maybe 70 pounds. My God, what a pig of a fish."
52 minutes into the battle, Bernie had the striper in the surf 30 yards right in front of him. We saw the leader and a flash of a big fin before the pig of a fish rolled over and started to shake its head against the pressure of the line and the hook. Then the fish ran, leaped out of the water, head still shaking, and crashed sideways into the surf. I was shocked at the size of it. So was Bernie.
"Jesus H," he said in awe. "He has to be pushing a world wreck!"
The striper thrashed once more. There was a twanging noise as the line snapped in two. Bernie staggered and fell back into the sand. I felt bad and expected him to be mad, curse his luck, or at least cry out in dismay. But Aaliyah's father just sat there in the sand, holding his fishing rod, staring at the surf and what could have been. After several minutes, he said,
"You get a chance at some things only once in this life, and sometimes they slip right through your hands.
I'll support you, Dr. Cross. One way or the other, I'll see to it that Tess gets the help you say she needs."
Chapter 22. John Sampson knocked on the doorframe of Bree Stone's office.
"Chief, we got her in interrogation," he said.
Bree looked up from a stack of papers, put her pen down, and got up. She and Sampson went to a booth with a one-way mirror overlooking an interrogation room. A young woman with elaborate parrot tattoos on both arms, multiple face piercings, and half her jet-black hair shaved off sat at the table staring at the mirror. In an accent that sounded straight out of Appalachia, she said,
"Sally Sweet doesn't have all day. You either want to know or you don't."
Detective Ainsley Fox was also in the observation booth. She said, "Let me talk to her alone, Chief. Get her to relate to me." Sampson wondered whether that was possible, given that Fox was one of the most abrasive, obnoxious people he'd ever worked with. Bree was skeptical, too, and shook her head. "Detective Sampson will take the lead. He has years of experience at this kind of thing." Fox scowled but offered no argument as she trailed Sampson out into the hallway. Sampson stopped and said,
"You listen, you study, you learn."
His partner did not like that, but she nodded. She and Sampson entered the interrogation room and sat down in front of the woman.
"Sally Sweet," he said after introducing himself.
"It's what my driver's license says," she said, smiling.
"For real, approved by the court even.
Taken in on charges of soliciting prostitution, Fox said, and possession of a controlled narcotic? Samson had to fight not to ask Fox to leave right then. Sweet shrugged. Like I told the vice cop, the oxy I got, legit. Cause of a herniated disc in my lumbar, and anyway, I got a get out of jail free card, and I want to use it.
Describe the card, Samson said.
It's a big one.
Fox leaned across the table as if to speak. Samson put his hand on his partner's thigh and squeezed it hard. Fox sat back and looked at his hand and then at him in outrage. Samson squeezed harder and then let go. He looked at Fox, then turned his head to Sweet, who couldn't figure out what was going on.
I can't promise you a thing until I hear what you have, Samson said, ignoring the fact that Fox's normal pale skin had gone beet red. If it's strong evidence, we'll inform the prosecutor who draws your case. In return for testimony, you'll get some kind of deal.
Sweet's lips curled as if she'd sniffed something foul.
I didn't say nothing about testifying. This is a tip. I give the tip to you. You let me go.
Fox was about to open her mouth, but Samson pushed back from the table, stood up and said,
I guess we're done then. You'll be taken back to Central Holding. Detective Fox.
Fox didn't move for a beat, but then stood up stiffly.
Wait, what?
The hooker said.
Shit. Okay, then. I'll talk. But Sweet Sal's got to get some good out of this.
Still ignoring Fox, Samson sat down and said,
So talk.
Sweet told him to check with the Kansas State Police for a missing persons report on a 17-year-old blonde, Emily McCabe of Wichita, who'd run away and came east after her uncle allegedly abused her. McCabe lived on the streets until she met a man named Neil Parks. He introduced her to coke, meth, and heroin and turned her into a call girl. Sally Sweet also worked for Parks, who set up meets with his girls and John's via smartphone like a cyber pimp.
Emily was good people, Sweet said. I liked her, even when she became Neil's favorite for a while.
Parks evidently lavished attention on the new girls, so they'd do anything he asked. Sweet had once been favored like that. In fact, she still had a key to the pimp's apartment.
Neil was holding cash back on me, and I knew where he kept it, Sweet said. Let me back up a second. Right around then, I hadn't been seeing Emily regular like I used to, and Neil said she'd gone up to New York to work for a friend of his for a few weeks. I waited until Neil went out to eat one night with another one of the girls, and I got into his place.
Sweet said she retrieved a lockbox hidden in the ductwork above Parks' computer desk, got the key for it from his dresser, opened it, and took out $1,500 in cash.
Just what he owed me, she said. I put the rest back.
What does this have to do with Emily? Fox said impatiently.
Smug. The hooker said, when I climbed up there to put the box back, I accidentally kicked Neil's computer mouse. The screen lit up on his desktop. There was a picture of Emily on the monitor.
Sweet realized the image was part of a video, so she played the clip.
It looked like Neil shot it with his GoPro, she said. From his, what do you call it, point of view?
Samson remembered the GoPro videos on the Killing Blonde Chicks for Fun website. And he nodded, thinking that Sweet's story might have legs after all.
What did you see? Fox said. Neil in full dominance mode, Sweet said, sounding shaken. He was hitting Emily, saying and doing nasty things to her, and she's all submissive. And then, like, he's got a rope in his hand, and he flips it around Emily's neck.
She stopped, her lip quivering at the memory.
Neil started to strangle her,
Sweet said at last.
He put the camera in her face. You could see how terrified she was before the screen went black.
Chapter 23. At home around 10:30 that evening, Bree said she was exhausted and going to bed.
You coming?
I said. I'm going to type up some notes downstairs, catch the 11 o'clock news, and then I'll be up.
Don't fall asleep in front of the TV again, she said, and she kissed me.
I'll try not to, I said, and I kissed her back.
You promised Jani and Ali you'd go for an early run with them.
I remember. Love you.
Love you too, she said, and waved her hand wearily as she left the room. I waited until Bree had climbed the stairs and shut our bedroom door before going to my basement office and putting on a dark jacket and baseball cap. Then I hit send on a text I'd written an hour before. I opened the outside door as quietly as I could, slipped out into the night, and went along the side of my house, creeping under our bedroom window. The light went out up there, and I trotted down the sidewalk to a waiting car. I climbed into the passenger seat. John Sampson was at the wheel.
Glad you could make it, he said, and then he smiled and put the car in gear.
You gonna explain why we have to sneak around, I said.
I am, Sampson said,
and he told me about Emily McCabe, Sally Sweet, the video Sweet saw on Neil Parks' computer, and how the clip had ended before the strangulation was complete.
You believe her? I said. We're here, aren't we?
Warrant?
We got blowback on the ask, Sampson said. Can't get a search authorization based solely on the hearsay of a prostitute eager to avoid jail time. But I figure blonde lives matter, and think we should have a chat with old Neil Parks sooner rather than later.
Why me? I asked. What about Fox?
Sampson shook his head wearily. She's threatening to file a complaint against me for squeezing her leg hard when she refused to follow my lead during my interrogation. She has total disregard for rank, even dissed Bree on the deal.
So things are going well between you?
Oh, yeah, just peachy, he said, which is why you're here.
For a talk?
I figure we rattle Parks' cage a little. See if we can shake anything loose. I knew I should ask him to pull over and get a taxi home.
Bree would have a fit if she found out I was out with one of her detectives and both of us were defying her direct orders. But still, it felt so good and achingly familiar to be rolling with Sampson late at night that I blocked out my promise to Bree.
We cruised through the city, heading for a saloon Neil Parks liked to frequent after 11 o'clock at night. The Parrot was a serious dive bar by D.C. standards. It occupied the first floor of a shabby six-story building near the Maryland state line. Parks lived on the fourth floor.
Convenient if you're an alcoholic, Sampson said.
Is he?
I said.
No idea, he said, parking down the street. Sally says he sits in a booth and handles business there until the Parrot shuts down, runs the whole thing off his phone. Cyberpimp.
How are we going to see the video clip of Emily McCabe?
I thought about just going up there to watch it for ourselves, Sampson admitted, climbing out of the squad car. But we risk fruit of the poisonous tree. If we can get a warrant, we don't want that clip excluded at trial.
Trial, I thought, getting out the other side. My own day in court was fast approaching, and yet I seemed to be doing everything I could to avoid facing the issue head on. What was that about?
There's an alley exit and the front door, Sampson said, gesturing down the block at the neon blue macaw flickering above the bar's entrance. I'd take the back, I said, but I'm unarmed.
John stopped, stooped into the car, and retrieved a small Ruger 9mm, which he handed to me.
I'm coming in the back, he said. You go in, make him, and wait.
I looked down at the pistol a moment, knowing this was the worst idea I'd had in weeks. But I stuck it in my waistband at the small of the back and pulled my shirt down over it. We split up. I strolled up the street and entered the Parrot. The place was a pleasant dive doing a healthy business, considering the hour. On the jukebox beyond the two pool tables, Lenny Kravitz was singing, "Are You Gonna Go My Way?" The bar itself was to my left. A row of booths lined the opposite wall. Photos, paintings, and posters featuring parrots were everywhere, and two live African gray parrots croaked and fluttered in a large wire cage near the center of the saloon. One of the parrots climbed the cage wall using its talons and beak. As I passed it on the way to the bar, the parrot cocked its head and goggle-eyed me a moment before squawking,
5-0, 5-0! How the bird knew baffles me to this day, but it just kept squawking, 5-0.
Many eyes were on me as I stepped up to the bar. The bartender ignored me, so I looked over my shoulder. On the other side of the parrot cage, a lanky guy was